This week on Decentralize,
GitHub under a massive denial of service attack,
borderless societies and seasetting.
Then we talk to Kane of the WWE, Glenn Jacobs.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Welcome to Decentralize. GitHub is under attack from China. I haven't really heard a lot of the technical details, but apparently it's Baidu. Eric, is that?
Yeah. So the details of this is like GitHub is under like a massive DDoS attack. Anyone who visits Baidu, which is effectively Google or the Google of China, in their browser, right? So from your home computer, from your laptop, wherever you are, it'll start firing off requests against GitHub.com. Which, as you can imagine, if you know a site like Google did that, that basically turns every user of Google into an agent of this attack. It's pretty crazy. Apparently, GitHub is saying that it's like the biggest DDoS in history for them, and GitHub's been around a long time. And GitHub also constantly comes under attack, right? Like one of the easiest ways of disrupting, you know, an idea you don't believe in is like to make it impossible for the people using that tool, GitHub in this case, to operate. It really pissed me off over the weekend. I'll just go ahead and say that. Like, I sent a few tweets, and I'm on this coding streak, right? Like, I think it's like day 93 now, and if I can't push code, then I'm going to miss my streak, right? Because the rule is not just write code, but publish it, open source to the world. And if I don't publish it, then it doesn't count. And I'm now in a position where, like, and they say, we're saying that it's China here because, all right, so Baidu is a Chinese-operated company. It's not clear whether it's actually Baidu, but after some investigation, it would appear that some of the devices right at the Chinese firewall, right where the edge of where they control their portion of the internet is where this malicious code is being inserted. So all signs point to either, you know, a very highly secured device has been compromised by some outside party, which would mean a whole host of other things, or it's actually being facilitated by the agency that operates that device, say the specific router. And it's being launched. So I was trying to push GitHub code to GitHub over the weekend, and there's this nation state kind of getting in the way of me and publishing open ideas. And the whole, from what I understand, the whole reasoning behind this is because of this project, greatfire.org. Many people have known about historically this the Great Firewall of China, where the government of China is controlling traffic, internet traffic. They censor the internet. They block a number of services. I think they block Google, for example. Google is completely blocked. Can't register for Google Mail in China. You have to use, you know, services that are Chinese companies, et cetera, or Chinese government services, for example. And greatfire.org is a sort of community organized, very pointed effort to sort of expose the Great Chinese Firewall. And help people get access to uncensored internet, right? Because that's, you know, as some agency declared, you know, this is a basic human right to get access to this, to the internet. And so presumably, you know, China has the motive, or some very, you know, parties that have very strong allegiance to China would have the motive to do this. So that's why we're sort of saying, you know, China is actually directly attacking a U.S. company in this case. And what makes that really interesting to me is not only, you know, is this, you know, interrupting service of people who are trying to do cool stuff like engineers and developers, and a lot of people use GitHub for education purposes. They put their course materials up there. But in 2012, there was actually an official statement released by the Department of Defense, for whatever that's worth, and the White House actually signed and authorized by Obama, that declares acts such as this, cyber attacks, I hate the word cyber, but declares cyber attacks as acts of war, like literally declares them as acts of war. Which means that, you know, use of military force would be authorized in return should any foreign nation state, you know, participate in a cyber attack of any sort, or, you know, penetrate the defenses of any U.S. government facility digitally, or an actual company. And it's funny because, you know, several cases over the past few years have come out. I mean, we think back to the Natanz reactor thing with Iran, and the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran, right? And it's pretty clear, but it's pretty clear to those in the security community who perpetrated those attacks. And yet, there's no declaration of war. There's no accountability for the U.S. government doing these things. And similarly, here we are with China, you know, firing shots, or some party within China, certainly not definitely sanctioned by the government, but it's seemingly so. And it's like a shadow war, right? It's like these people are like sort of, there is a world war going on right now, and they're just, it's all proxy wars, right? Like they're not actually admitting it. And that kind of worries me.
Yeah, so GitHub was able to mitigate the attack yesterday, but is the DOD, is the Department of Defense doing anything about this?
No, there has been zero response from the Department of Defense or the White House. And in fact, this didn't get any press coverage. Like, you know, when you're watching the new, like the television and radio media, like there's nothing covering this. And in my opinion, this is perhaps one of the most newsworthy events we've seen in a long time. I mean, we've got posts on, you know, okay, it's a few days later now. We've got Ars Technica, we've got, you know, a couple other digitally focused things. But it strikes me that, you know, the population at large just is, you know, completely, like, they have their blinders on. They don't know that this whole world out there is existing, and there are battles being fought on it, if not outright wars.
Well, if this is Baidu and the Chinese government, they obviously probably set out trying to go after a small fish, thinking, oh, GitHub, you know, it's just the coders and the nerds out there. But they're really attacking something that's symbolic of probably the opposite of really what they stand for, which is kind of this open collaborative community. And I think it's going to pick up more legs as this attack continues and as more people become aware of this issue. And, like, you know, how can you attack GitHub, man? I mean, the cute little, like, fish cat thing. I mean,
The OctoCat.
And I just started really using GitHub really more often recently. And it's just, this is a platform. This is not, you know, a particular agenda. But of course, any kind of platform like that, especially ones that are more decentralized, and GitHub certainly has aspects of that in its organization, does represent a threat to these governments and to these corporations like Baidu, perhaps, particularly with hosting the Great Fire. And I think, you know, it's just another case of long line of these incidents in the past few years, starting with the Silk Road, et cetera. And perhaps we never thought we'd see GitHub in the same sort of situation. And I certainly hope this doesn't escalate into something like cyber war that we've been warned about for so long, and these dire predictions by the Department of Defense. But I do hope there are ways we can work around it and route around it. Yeah. And I hope Eric can continue his coding streak, because by golly, like, get out of the way, China. Let him code.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this isn't the first time that GitHub has come under attack. I mean, it's even come under attack, domestic attack, by corporations like, you know, the RIAA and MPAA, who've, you know, issued legal attacks, right? DMCAs of any developer who's posted code related to this or has these words in it, take their code down. And by law, by U.S. law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I think it was enacted in 1977 or 1997.
98.
Okay. So there's a specific clause where if you operate a network service, and you can operate under the Safe Harbor Clause if you comply with these following steps. And one of those steps is if someone who claims to be a copyright holder submits a DMCA claim to you saying a takedown notice, you are required within a 24-hour window of time, I think it actually says reasonable amount of time, I'm not sure about the actual language, that you take down that content, right? And then there are very, very weak guidelines for what happens when someone incorrectly represents, you know, being the holder of a copyright. And GitHub gets this all the time, and it ticks coders off. I mean, if you just quickly do a DuckDuckGo search for this, you'll see that there's like five or six different cases over the past year where this has like interrupted the work of very large scale projects. And it's sort of against the whole open source ethos, right? Like, I mean, GitHub itself may not be open source, but they certainly have brought about this new perspective or this newfound energy and vigor in the open source community. And it's not going to be it's not the first, and it certainly won't be the last time. But the internet, as they say, routes around damage. And the only problem with GitHub right now is that it's a centralized entity. What is going to happen, whether it's in response to this specific incident or the growing trend, is we will find a way to collaborate on engineering projects with or without, you know, the vulnerability of these sort of attacks. We will decentralize this as well. And that's what I'm looking forward to.
Are there any projects out there right now which are already implementing something like this for kind of decentralized collaboration?
So Git itself, without GitHub, is fundamentally decentralized. Linus Torvalds, the creator of Linux, created Git, and he was sick and tired of previous version control systems, you know, like requiring you to check out the file, and it didn't have a very asynchronous flow, right? You had to sort of make sure that you were working on different parts of a project all at once. So the creation of Git allows for decentralized communication, but it never really took hold until the centralized, really nice, clean way of proposing changes, the pull request, is what I think is the most important feature on GitHub. It really didn't take hold until GitHub came along, right? We had SourceForge, but now that we have GitHub and you go back and look at SourceForge, it's like, holy crap, we used to like this thing. But there's none. This sort of gets at a larger problem, right? And this is the compute problem. Ethereum is trying to play in this space. Codeus.org is trying to play in this space. We can't build a fully decentralized web service just yet. We don't know exactly how to do it. And the technical challenge is, all right, well, in order to build something truly decentralized, you need a way to verify the computations that are running on the network at a far cheaper cost than the initial computation is performed itself. So the Bitcoin network has solved this problem for the monetary and data tracking system, for tracking a ledger. But it has not solved this for the computing. And Bitcoin solves it because computing the hashes, or figuring out what the nonce to put into the hashes to get the appropriate hash, is very hard, but verifying it is very easy because all you do is share the nonce and people can look at the transactions and bam, it matches. And you can spend far less CPU power verifying than you do actually figuring out what the next block is. So with compute, it's a much harder problem because you need to fully verify every single thing that's gone through, and there's no way to reduce that cost for verifiers versus, not that we've found yet, for verifiers versus the first person to service the request. Once we have that, it's going to be very easy. We will see a flood of decentralized services. We'll definitely see a decentralized version of GitHub. It'll be like Git Mesh or something like that, which would be really cool if anybody's working on decentralized, you know, web platforms. Build Git Mesh, and the rest will follow. It'll happen, but it is a hard problem to solve. In the similar way that it took so long to solve, you know, the distributed data store and accounting problem that Bitcoin was created from, right? It's going to take a long time to do this for compute, too.
Yeah, I'd be willing to bet that GitHub will probably be looking into more ways to just kind of decentralize its service, at least partially, after this attack. I mean, right now they kind of present a single front and a single point of failure in some respects. I mean, not all, obviously. And they've refused to take down the sites which they believe are being targeted, the Great Wall Mirror and the Mirror of the New York Times. But I'm sure they'll be exploring ways to kind of reduce both their liability and like sort of their increase their plausible deniability, and also give sort of more redundancy and robustness to the repositories on GitHub.
Yeah.
And but really, one of the things, like one of the best ways to make anything redundant is to make it global. And one of the interesting things about this case is that GitHub was actually previously banned in China for at least a couple of years. But the outcry from developers at these companies like Baidu was actually really sort of what, at least, you know, prompted on a surface level, prompted the Chinese government to legalize it. But what's more interesting about that and about sort of the strength of this sort of global collaboration network is that it does have, I think, strong applications to sort of the question of decentralization and the question of how we get the best talent to the places where it's most needed. One of the things which really affects this is rules around immigration, because really with GitHub, there's obviously no immigration rules, there's no borders, you can collaborate anywhere. But I think increasingly we're seeing things like visas, things like borders, passports, kind of things of this old centralized world, physical world, posing a lot of obstacles to people trying to actually come maybe to the United States, maybe to go to China, and really put the best use of their talents to use. And the reason I bring this up is Open Borders Day was actually celebrated, I think, 3 Sundays ago, And I recently read this great article by Paul Graham called Let the Other 95% of Great Programmers In. And he makes a great point that really good coders can be trained, but great coders, people who actually invent things and think of things no one's thought of, they're ever so rare. And they are pretty much, if we do assume they're evenly distributed around the world, United States only has 5% of the world's population. So with things like visas, which are exceedingly difficult to acquire, even if you are a highly skilled engineer, these things do block a lot of great talent from coming in. Obviously, we do have the workarounds like GitHub, and we definitely want to talk about that more. But right now, we do see a lot of problems with this. And I'm wondering sort of y'all's thoughts on, y'all have been in the engineering space longer than I. Have you seen actually great coders being prevented from coming into your workplaces or collaboration prevented because of these sort of restrictions?
Yeah, so I've worked with a lot of really great engineers that have come from other countries, and the hoops that they have to jump through just to be able to work in the U.S., you know, highly qualified, really intelligent people that are building really cool things, and, you know, there's a waiting list, you know, a mile long, and, you know, fee after another fee, and it's just, you know, ridiculous that we're making all these really intelligent people jump through all these hoops.
Yeah, and so like at BitPay, right? Like we, as a startup, we had a very limited amount of money very early on, but we needed to have, you know, intellectual capital to build out all the stuff that we wanted to build. We had people we had to turn down from other countries. They were, you know, all 100% greenlit. Go do hire this person. But when it turns out that, you know, they're overseas and we're not going to pay, what is it? I think it's like $10,000.
Tens of thousands of dollars
to get someone to sponsor someone on a visa. Like, and we've got, so what we did is we just opened an office in those countries. Like, so screw it. Like, we'll just, yeah. We now have two offices in Argentina and we just hired everybody there, right? Forget this whole state system and trying to get a visa. Like, we would rather just hire them right where they are and let them stay comfortable and continue being great right there. And it has really showed. I mean, some of our best work is a result of those engineers in other countries, right?
Absolutely. You know, Wired put out a great story, I think about 10 years ago now, actually. It's recently highlighted because there's a movie being made about it. But this group of four students from Phoenix, Arizona, four undocumented Mexican immigrants, they actually competed in a underwater robotics competition against students from MIT and won high school students against college students. Coming from, you know, what most people would say unlikely backgrounds, obviously, you know, having sort of different experiences, different backgrounds. But it does kind of go to show you that if you really think with a very insular mindset, both culturally and politically, yeah. You are missing a lot of contributions from the most unlikely places, and you're missing the other 95%. But what you said earlier, Eric, about, you know, sort of what BitPay did to work around that limitation, that's like a very... That's honestly one of the more traditional ways to kind of go about this is like if you can expand and physically into another location, that's a great way to kind of work around these limitations of these centralized entities because, you know, we're moving into a world where those things really don't matter. I mean, I would argue they never really did, but increasingly to actually produce economic output,
yeah,
it's just not necessary. But like that's even more traditional, like actually physically moving to a place. And a lot of places can't afford that or do that. But I'm really interested in how these decentralized technologies can actually help us to expand and work together, like as people, yeah. Beyond these sort of barriers. And I think there are a number of ways to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that strikes me is like borders really are artifacts of an old society, right? Borders exist because people felt the need to rise and organize other people around them. For in some cases. Well-meaning ends, right? Like, in some cases. I mean, okay, so we can go to feudalism and, you know, sort of all of these, like, you know, cases where it was really bad. But, I mean, sometimes, like, you look around you and you're like, hey, what if I get together with a few of my neighbors and we agree together to build something better? Because you took that initiative, like, you're kind of the person who started that, right? It's when it starts to turn sour, right? That's where it becomes a very bad thing. And it's very easy to do that, and you can see most nations have become this. But the problem is that the technology to actually build decentralized sort of organizations and sort of whatever it may be didn't exist, right? The only reason a republic exists, or the U.S. is a democratic republic, is because it wasn't possible at the time to have everybody vote. So they sent their delegate, right, you know, 3 days travel up to go vote. And that's how it worked, because you couldn't have everybody amass themselves in the same place at the same time to go ahead and figure out what they wanted to do with themselves. Because it's a noble idea in principle, right, to have everybody, you know, have their input or say into what happens and make everybody equal. But in practice, it falls completely apart. It's just not a tenable situation. The only way things will work is when you have individual liberty and individual freedom, and you have the freedom, sole domain over yourself, right? And you choose to interact with people around you, and they have sole sovereignty over themselves.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the only way that it can work. And when you want to align with a group of other people who might have similar goals and objectives, or may have some value transfer that allows them all to receive a fair share of an outcome of a specific organization, then so be it. But these things need to be very loosely coupled, right? You start seeing like the rigidity of, you know, having borders, having nations sort of emerge and manifest itself as all of these negative, having all these negative effects, right? And, you know, we talked earlier about the whole GitHub China issue. Every function of a nation is slow by its very nature of size, because it places the power and the expectation of power on a centralized authority rather than on the edges, on the very like the actual people, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons for borders we can definitely analyze on a more political theory level. But in this case, you know, it seems to always echo the same kind of restraints on trade, protectionism and goods, except in labor this time, labor and intelligence. And as with anything, I mean, a lot of times, especially in our communities, we're seeing changes made to that not really coming from the political theory perspective or from the political action perspective, but from entrepreneurs and technologists working on these things. And there are a number of ways of doing, of like really working around these barriers and getting people to where, you know, they really want to work and where they can produce the most value. And like at the very basic level, the internet's done that. I mean, you can now Skype call and work remotely. That in itself is sort of a death knell for borders in a practical sense as an economic limitation. But I think we're seeing a lot more really creative and interesting ways of doing this. Now, one of these that's been around for, I think, about a decade, but the idea has been around longer, is the idea of seasteading, where you have basically like colonies and communities in offshore international waters, unrestricted by these immigration rules, where people can come together and work and live and develop their kind of their own ways of living. And a civic one of these actually recently, though it's no longer in action, is the Blue Seed Project. And the idea was like to rent a decommissioned cruise ship off the coast of California and allow people with sort of lesser visas to actually be able to come together and work there in office space offshore and travel to the mainland every now and then. But like, these are all just very creative ways of doing it. I think we'll be seeing a lot more. I mean, just the peer-to-peer communication, peer-to-peer money, Bitcoin. I mean, like, this is like you no longer need to go through capital controls of various nation states. Same thing is going to happen for individuals, I think.
Yeah, when I first heard about some of these seasteading projects, I got really excited. I was like, oh man, like we can actually go build something new from fresh, not have to deal with all the old paradigms. And I'm sad to hear that Blue Seed actually, unfortunately, is no longer operational. Is that accurate?
I think they've suspended the project briefly, perhaps due to funding.
It's probably super expensive. If I remember correctly, was someone from Google involved in Blue Seed?
I'm not aware. I do believe it was actually two tech executives, perhaps with backgrounds in immigration.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I don't have that information.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, I mean, you see these entrepreneurs and these people trying to build companies and businesses and provide capital to the rest of society, provide a service or a good, right? You see them working around these arbitrary, you know, draconic measures. And Blue Seed is an example. Seasteading is an example. It's going to be a while, unfortunately, before it's really practical, or it's going to take some crazy billionaire to just drop it. And
Richard Branson in space. We all work together in space in a rocket.
I honestly think like
to the moon.
Yeah, to the moon. Absolutely. Like one of my companies is going to be a space company, and I think that might be it.
Well, these seem like kind of ineffective ways to solve the problem.
No, we just got to go to space.
We're wrapping duct tape around a leaking pipe. We just need to replace the pipe.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I think actually like getting to a point where, I mean, asking for the abolition or even the reduction of border controls to some extent, that's a very tall order to ask for from a political perspective. Yeah. I mean, it's a very core part of like the idea of the nation state is like restricting movement of individuals under different domains. So I think in the meantime, I am very excited about these. Perhaps not so much about the moon thing. I mean, if we can get that, I will be. But in the meantime, there's some really interesting ways of doing that. I mean, whether it's just, you know, heck, we can do that with our own podcast. We can podcast with someone halfway around the world, have the same sound as if he's in the same room with us, but obviously not have to go through quite all the challenges of that. And I think we've done that quite a bit, and we've had some really interesting guests. And I know this week coming up, we have quite an interesting one from quite a different area, perhaps, but I think quite related to what we're talking about. We'll be joined by Glenn Jacobs, WWE wrestler who operates under the name Kane.
Yeah, Glenn is also a writer and a libertarian, so we're really excited to have him on the show.
We're joined by Glenn Jacobs of the WWE, who wrestles under the name Kane. He's also an outspoken writer and speaker on libertarian ideas, and we're very glad to have him on the show. Thanks for joining us, Glenn.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
So our first question, Glenn, is you've actually written a very interesting article on Bitcoin, but you've also written on a number of topics related to sort of the ideas of libertarianism. We're wondering how sort of you encountered these ideas coming from a wrestling background and sort of what they mean to you.
It was one of my coworkers that actually introduced me to the term libertarian. We would talk, and I told him that I agreed with the left on some things, the right on some things, and he told me that I sounded like a libertarian, and I told him that if he kept calling me names, we were going to get into a fight. So I didn't even know what it meant at the time. But I started doing a little research. I went to the Libertarian Party website, and I joined the Libertarian Party, but I was what I would now consider or term a term that I've sort of coined, but an ad hoc libertarian, in that I would look at the issues and say, yeah, I agree with some of this, or I don't agree with some of that. And it wasn't until I really started delving into the political philosophy, the libertarian philosophy, that I realized that philosophy, it's not just, oh, okay, yeah, this is what I think about this, this is what I think about that, and of course it all revolves around the action of non-aggression, and that line of thinking. And from there, I discovered Austrian economics, because of course Austrian economics is the only school of economics which is absolutely free market, with no state intervention, and many of the great Austrian economists are, because of that, of course, libertarian in their political philosophy, people like Murray Rothbard and Ron Paul and F.A. Hayek and Mises, Ludwig Mises. So that's how it really came about. It was just an evolution in my development as a human being.
That's totally fascinating, Glenn. And how did you sort of encounter? Did you encounter this mostly through kind of reading the great Austrian economist? Who was sort of your one of your main intellectual influences in this journey?
Sure. I actually read about libertarianism first, and that's how I discovered Larry Rothbard. Is I was reading Rothbard's libertarian philosophy, his works about libertarian philosophy, and that's how I discovered Austrian economics. I think a lot of people do the reverse. You know, they read Rothbard's Austrian economics stuff, and of course, because it's Austrian economics in itself is libertarian in nature, you know, that's how they discovered the philosophy. I did the opposite. But of course, he's been very influential on my thinking. Frederick Bastiat, the great 19th century French statesman and economist, Ron Paul, who has been a libertarian, but at this point hasn't somewhat been influenced by Ron Paul, Hayek, and Mises as well, as well as many others. I mean, even people like Lysander Spooner. You know, I think that Spooner was great. You know, he's not an economist per se, but his kind of philosophy on here also, decentralization and that sort of thing, I think was remarkable. He was definitely a man ahead of his time.
Indeed, that was actually really my experience, was finding these thinkers through a lot of these. So it's very interesting to see the commonalities in sort of these ideas of libertarianism, and as we call it, decentralism, you know, this sort of general idea of wanting to kind of distribute power and freedom to people. So I think Tony had a question for you.
I did, and it's actually a question in general with what you were talking about a minute ago when you were talking about a coworker. And there's, you know, there's become a lot more high profile folks in this scene, not just, you know, as we like to call decentralization, that part, but more so the libertarian part. And I know there's a picture of you on the internet with Vince Vaughn, and he's another one that's very much influenced in this scene. What other people have you met in this scene that are interesting, and why do you think it's really attracting a wide variety of different types of people?
Well, I think just the proof is in the pudding at this point. You know, Harriet Brown, who was also in Huntsall, I think, in her book, Whatever Doesn't Work, and at this point we're seeing the fruits of government, and especially big government, and why it doesn't work. And that's attracting more and more people to the cause of liberty, you know, and really we are talking about decentralization, decentralization down to the point of the individual. You know, Ayn Rand said that the smallest minority in the world is the individual, and that's what really counts, is the power of the individual. So, and I think that is what attracts so many people. I have met some really, really cool folks. A few weeks ago, I was on an airplane with Judge Napolitano, you know, and so we got to talk for a little while. I've also met Penn and Teller, which is really cool, and was at their show in Vegas, and it was awesome because they had the skit where they talk about, you know, of course, Gillette does all the talking, but he says that Penn does all the talking. He says, you know, we used to travel a lot for our work, but we're libertarians and we don't like this. And they bring out the metal detector, and that becomes part of their whole skit. Now they, you know, he basically takes swords to the metal detector without getting caught and stuff like that. And I think people like that, and Vince Vaughn I've also met, and he's, I don't know if he's necessarily libertarian per se, but he definitely sees a lot of value in what Ron Paul says. And what's great about those folks is they have a voice outside of the political realm. You know, what I find that a lot of people, you have people that watch the news, and you have, unfortunately, those folks have really been indoctrinated into a single way of thinking, and their life, which network they watch. On the other hand, you have people that don't care at all and don't watch the news at all. And what's really cool about you know, folks like Penn and Teller, especially the fact that they can appeal to those people in an apolitical fashion and bring them into the philosophy without ever having to get into, you know, the whole electoral politics stuff, which at this point is really just a personality contest. You know, if you look at people in electoral politics, all they have to say is, you like me more than him, more so than really what they believe, because most of them actually believe the same thing. So that's what's really cool about many of the folks that I've had the pleasure and opportunity to meet, is how they can cross away from, or they can get away from truly political realm into other realms and entertainment and bring people in that way. You know, I think one of the most important people for the Liberty Movement, despite the fact that I know the grizzler on some things, was Ayn Rand, because Atlas Shrugged is such a popular book, and it doesn't assault people with dry political philosophy. It's a story that they can get into, and at the end of it, they go, oh, I get it. Same with the series Firefly. You know, there's a lot of libertarian elements in that. And that's actually one of the things that I think is very important, is creating more works like that as opposed to just more reams of politics and economics and tones on those issues, to bring people in a way that is much more entertaining and maybe even less threatening for them.
Oh man, I have to totally agree with that sentiment. I mean, we're very interested in these ideas and the philosophy of it. I mean, it's definitely why decentralism and kind of these ideas in general are so interesting. But the politics of it can be so, like you said, so dry and just so so frustrating. You know, it's outside of individual control. But I'm really interested in sort of how have you used your platform, both as an individual and as someone involved in the WWE and sort of with these celebrities, to kind of promote these ideas out, like you said, outside of in a sort of an apolitical and entertaining way.
Well, I sort of use the opposite. I can't, because I don't, you know, have that much control over what happens to that Bitmain. I'm not, you know, I don't write storylines or anything like that. There's, I have very limited ability to really do anything to that. But because of who I am and because I do have somewhat of a celebrity status, and for better or for worse, people seem to be interested in what people like me say, I am able to, you know, to do some things. But most of mine is actually political and economic writing or speaking. And I, especially with younger people, I find is who I really enjoy working with. In fact, I'm thrilled because next month, I live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and next month I'll be doing a presentation at the University of Tennessee, sponsored by the Young Americans for Liberty, and it's going to be all about libertarian philosophy and that sort of thing. And I'm really excited about that. And that's more of what I try to do, is I try to use my persona as a you know, as a personality in the media and entertainment as a broader way into introducing people to the ideas of liberty.
Awesome.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tony.
Yeah, absolutely sounds great. And, you know, I'm someone who is a longtime WWE fan, so I have to say that the corporate Kane character, I think, matches the personality of a libertarian-esque Glenn very well. So I do love it. And I guess... Well, go ahead, sorry.
The most evil character I've ever played, because now you have, you know, he's a politician. I mean, he's a psychopath with power. You know?
Absolutely. Evil kind of person in my book. I would agree completely. But to flip the page a little bit, there's a very interesting article you penned a little over a year ago about Bitcoin. And you were skeptical, and it interested me at the time, and it was at the time when Bitcoin was very high. What exactly would you say your opinion is now of Bitcoin? Now that it's been a year, the price has went down a lot, but the technology has actually grown a lot, and in addition to that, one of your main qualms or concerns about it was that it doesn't live up to the standards set by gold and silver. Go on a little bit about what your concerns were in addition to what I said, and further what I said a little bit.
Sure. And first of all, I'd like to say that I respect everyone who's doing anything with Bitcoin, and I certainly sympathize with you, those folks that are doing stuff with Bitcoin, because I think cryptocurrencies and alternative currencies are very important. So I don't want to alienate anyone in thinking that, oh, what the work you're doing is important, because I think it is. Specifically with Bitcoin, let me reinforce that, you know, by saying that the most powerful thing, weapon, tool, whatever you want to call it, that the state or the government has is its monopoly over money. I mean, that's why governments always have a monopoly on money, because that's the way you control society, and you do it through soft power. I mean, you can have your police state, you can have your military, whatever, but it's really the control of money which is that soft power that people aren't going to revolt against, because the other stuff is, you know, that's the boot on people's face, that's the boot on society's face. But when you use money, that's the velvet glove covering the iron fist. So that's the one power that the state has never, in my opinion, would give up. I mean, you know, even if you look back at the Constitution and the fact that when it talks about money, gold and silver are recognized as money, and really that was a very important distinction. You know, nowadays when the Federal Reserve talks about creating money, that's a power that was never delegated to anyone by the Constitution, to Congress. So it's not a power that Congress can delegate to anyone else, because money already exists. It wasn't created. It wasn't created like Ben Bernanke actually wants famously that the Fed does. That being said, and I guess I'm old fashioned, but my concerns about Bitcoin was, first of all, it's unconventional in that, and again, I'm probably old fashioned. I realize that we're moving into new realms that we've never been into before with things like the internet and the again, with Bitcoin, you, I think the Hayek was, F.A. Hayek, was absolutely right. And they have maybe, and the Mark, you would have many different currencies competing with one another. You may see actually gold and silver, as well as Bitcoin, as well as Amazon issuing money, as well as Walmart issuing money. And what's going to happen is, of course, whatever the best money is going to win. Or in some cases, they may all still be there. Who knows? But my concern with Bitcoin is it's unconventional in that it wasn't something that emerged on the market spontaneously. And what I mean by that is, with gold and silver and other forms of money, they were already there. And people were already using them, and they sort of gained universal acceptance or recognition. That's not only the case with Bitcoin, in that it was still sort of planned currency. I don't understand it, and I'm not a technophobe by any stretch of imagination. I'm certainly not as technically literate as you guys are, but I mean, I still, I'm still on the internet, and I still keep up with a lot of changes. And I mean, I understand that it's an algorithm, and a lot of things go along with Bitcoin. But as far as being something that I can tangibly understand, like something that has value intrinsically. And we can argue about intrinsic value, meaning nothing actually does have intrinsic value, but, if I can hold certain things, right, they're tangible. With Bitcoin, that's not the case. So that's one of my concerns. And also, I think the thing that concerns me the most, and this may sound conspiratorial, but it's the fact that the state didn't move in and automatically, just immediately try to crush Bitcoin. In fact, it has been embraced, albeit in a lukewarm fashion, by the state. I mean, even the Fed has come out and said, yes, this might be a good alternative currency. And that really bothers me because, as I said initially, the state is never going to let anything threaten its monopoly on money. And I really worry that someday, we'll know, where Bitcoin stands if the government ever allows you to pay your taxes in it. Because if it does that, then I think we're going to know. I don't have, I have a lot of respect for the people that are working with Bitcoin. It's just, I think there are problems with that particular currency.
Absolutely. And what I would say in addition to that is that with your whole statement on the government controlling it and your conspiratorial statement, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that the reason that they haven't went after it harder is because of the decentralized nature, because there's computers around the world that are needed to be running the Bitcoin software in order for it, in order for it to exist. And since it's computers all around the world, there's really not one way a central government could shut that down. And I would say a similar example is piracy on the internet, like BitTorrent. There's been so many attempts to shut that down, and they don't. If people want to pirate and they want to take it, they're going to. And that's just an example I can make on that end. I think what you're saying as far as the intrinsic value is something that is a perception issue. And I agree with you. It is a big obstacle Bitcoin has. There's people that are used to, getting their paycheck and going to the bank and going to the ATM and taking out money. And, even though a lot of their transactions are done with money they never see, they don't really think that, because they can also access that money via a physical form very easily. I think it is a perception thing that will need to change over time in order for something like this to, really grow. So I think all of your concerns are very, very valid. The government one is something that shocked me too when I became a part of this whole scene, is how they haven't clued in and kind of shut this down. And then you go, that's because it's very difficult for them to do that. Very difficult.
And your points are valid, and as you say, everything, when we say intrinsic value, that's not the correct term. It's perceived value. And certainly with the new generation of people that are more used to dealing with digital digits, whether we call them dollars or whatever, as opposed to, even having money in their wallets, that does become much less of an issue. I think what's going to happen with Bitcoin is, I think the government's just going to try to co-opt it. Because, as you say, it is decentralized, and they've gone after guys like, Kim.com and stuff like that, but they haven't had a whole lot of success because they're just everywhere, or they're in jurisdictions where they can't be touched. But I think what they're going to try to do with Bitcoin, and that's why they are embracing it, is they're going to try to co-opt it, and they're eventually going to try to be the ones to control it. Because, yeah, someone, whether it's Bitcoin or something else, because of this wonderful thing that we call the internet, someone's going to figure out a way that they're going to be able to circumnavigate the government's monopoly on money. And that's a tremendous threat. So I think that they're already taking steps to try to co-opt Bitcoin. And my theory is that a lot of my friends who are very much into Bitcoin and see it as the sort of panacea that's going to break the back of the government, a big government, I should say. I think that the government's not as stupid as we think it is. It's not as clumsy as we think it is either. When something really threatens the state, it can act brutally and effectively. And, the reason that we think the government's slow and cumbersome is because it doesn't do what most people think that it should do, really because the incentives aren't correct. You know, the economic incentives that the state operates by are not the same that we do in our lives. So, therefore, the things that we think that we would like the government to do, it doesn't really have an incentive to do those things. But when it does have an incentive to do something, because it is so powerful and has so much blunt power that it can use, it can be pretty effective. And as I said, I think with Bitcoin, what they're going to try to do is probably try to co-opt it. And that becomes very dangerous for the people that are using Bitcoin, who think that, you know, this is a safe thing to use, and this is the future, that's going to have a big impact on breaking the back of the state.
Indeed, yeah. It's definitely a concern that a lot of us sort of in this Bitcoin community have. Tony and I are very, very much involved in projects, definitely relating to this thing to see over the next few years. And like you raise in a legitimate concern, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of fear. But that's kind of why we exist. We're really about highlighting the decentralized technologies, which not necessarily strike fear, but, you know, provide consistent solutions to monopolies, state-imposed monopolies, whatever they happen to be.
Sure.
But I know you wrote a little bit in your piece, actually, sort of about the idea of finding the best solution for this in terms of competing currencies. And what do you think is important in terms of competing? Like, why do you think competing currencies are really important? And what do you think is the best way to do that? What in your opinion, is the ideal money? And I think Tony actually sort of had a question relating to this.
Sure. That's not for me to determine. It's for the market to determine. When I say the market, I'm really talking about consumer preference and what works best. And therefore, I don't know. I think that in my own personal opinion, and this is my own personal opinion, I'm not a predictor of the future. And again, it will be the market to determine what the best sort of money or monies is or are. But James Turk. And what gold money is digital. In dedicated accounts, dedicated vaults in various places around the world, and basically it's digitally moved around. So you can pay for grams of gold from people, and of course it's the vaults are audited regularly by a respectable firm and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's where the future if things were out, you know, you still have your digital element, don't have something tangible. But as you say, you know, you still aren't touching it. But there is that link to something tangible, and you can actually request and then have the gold delivered for a fee, of course. And that's what's attractive to me, something like that. But nevertheless, again, I think we're going to see all sorts of money evolve. I mean, as already Amazon has talked about issuing their own money. I mean, we may see Walmart and Wallbox or something like that. Who knows? And that's really just like everything. It's competition on the market that what the best one is.
Absolutely. The first thing I wanted to say is thank you so much for taking time with us. I want to ask one more question before we let you go, but I know personally that it's a busy week for you with WrestleMania and everything. So first and foremost, thank you for that. And the final question I had to ask was, is there any reading materials you recommend to our audience to check out, just on various economic subjects, libertarianism in general? Because the one that James segued into that I wanted to ask about was Ideal Money, which is a paper by John Nash from Princeton of beautiful mind fame, and it describes something very similar to Bitcoin. There's many of the conspiratorial types that think that he's involved with Bitcoin as Satoshi. I don't know about that, but I do know that his Ideal Money paper is something that influenced me when I read it, so I figured that you would have some other equally important influences to you that you would recommend our audience to check out.
Sure, much stuff at this point, and thank goodness for the internet, because I certainly wouldn't be where I am philosophically if it hadn't been for the internet, because frankly, I just wouldn't have had access to most of the stuff. For general libertarian philosophy, I think if you're, especially if you have friends that are, consider themselves either conservatives or liberals. For people that are coming from the right, I think Harry Brown's stuff is really good. His book, Why Government Doesn't Work, for someone who is more of the conservative bent, is excellent. For someone who's more of a liberal and sort of touchy-feely, I think Dr. Mary Roach, Healing Our World and the Age of Aggression, is excellent. Then, of course, you have things like The Oldies But the Goodies, The Wall, That Which Is Seen, That Which Is Unseen by Bastiat are excellent. The Road to Serfdom, Hayek wrote that during World War II, and basically the theme of the book is that Europe, by doing what they were doing to fight the Nazis, were becoming more and more collectivist, which is, of course, Britain, I should say. I was becoming more and more collectivist, which, of course, was a big danger. Ayn Rand, her stuff is really good as far as the importance of the individual. Rand is particularly important because she was from Russia, and she was there when the stuff was going down, and she saw the terrible problems that collectivism wreaks. Stuff by Ron Paul, Liberty Defined, the Revolution of the Manifesto is excellent. Tom Woods as well, Judge Napolitano, and pretty much anything in Judge Napolitano has written. And probably the most important book, it needs updating, and this is a project that I've thought about, is actually writing a new edition or version of Economics in One Lesson, because it's a great book, but it was written in when McFadden went around, I guess, in the 40s or 50s, and we desperately need a new, not to say there's anything wrong with Hazlitt's work, but it was written for that generation. We definitely need someone, to write basically another Economics in One Lesson that's focused on this generation. And I don't know if I have the ability to do that, but it's still a great book, Economics in One Lesson by Hazlitt. And then, of course, our Rothbard stuff is really great. For New Liberty is excellent. And if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, Get the Market for Liberty by, I think it's, it's Lyndon Morris Tannehill, which takes you pretty far down the rabbit hole, but it's excellent. And another fictional novel that's very good, a lot of stuff by F. Paul Wilson, the science fiction fantasy writer, is very good, especially his first book, which is titled An Enemy of the State. So, but there's a lot of stuff, but any of that I don't think you can go wrong with.
Glenn, I absolutely think you should write the second edition of Economics in One Lesson. you know this back and forth, and you've really delved into the literature, and we're really excited to have had you on and talk about sort of this philosophy, because we talk a lot about the technology on this show, but it's really also important to kind of consider some of the ideas behind sort of the idea of decentralism. And it's really been a pleasure. So
I know our listeners can find you at adventuresofcitizenx.com for your writing. Where else can they can sort of encounter your talks, your events, and other featured writing of yours?
Well, of course, there's stuff on YouTube. I've also written for lourockwell.com, as well as The Daily Callers has written some of my stuff, as has where.us. And I know that some of my talks are on YouTube. So, you know, and hopefully there'll be more to come. But I really enjoyed it, guys. And I think the work you guys are doing is very important, especially the technology, because we do live in a world now which is decentralized because of the internet and the technology that provides. And as I said before, I wouldn't be where I am philosophically if it wasn't for the internet. So it empowers us on many, many levels. And I think that it's really admirable, you know, the work that you guys and other people are doing with technology.
Well, thank you, Glenn. We'll be continuing that, and we wish you the best as you continue your work, because it's very important to educate as well.
I appreciate it, guys. Have a great one.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm. or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralize-podcasts. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.